I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show starts with a little story.
I thought antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications were a crutch. It was just a way to run from your problems, to stuff them down, to live in a medicated fog. And I was very wrong, but I didn't know it until a doctor prescribed that kind of medicine to someone I loved. And she didn't go into a fog. She came out of one. And years later, my mind has completely changed. It's gone 180 about antidepressants and many other things. And so I sit here now and I wonder, what else am I wrong about? What else will the future version of me look back on and shake his head over how I was so naive?
Oh, man. David, that is something so relatable. David is with us. He's a journalist. He's got a podcast called You Are Not So Smart, and it is about people's relationships with their most deeply held convictions. He's now writing a book about what it takes to change someone's mind. He's visited the Westboro Baptist Church, talked to former cult leaders, people with strong feelings about vaccines, and he's going to help us understand how changes of heart ever come about in this polarized world of ours, where we follow news that confirms our biases and pick friends the same way. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a story like David's about changing your mind, whether the issue is big, like, say, gun control, or small, like, I don't know, the usefulness of sporks. It can be anything. 816-235-2888. David, I like this idea of past selves who object strongly to the views you now hold.
Yeah, this is really all where my project started from, because I had been in the position where a lot of people had asked me, this is before our current sort of epistemic crisis of post-truth and, you know, we're in a post-fact world and fake news and all that. But back before that really started brewing, people had asked me, how do you change, you know, people's minds? How do you get my dad to change his mind about Barack Obama, stuff like that? And I was pretty much of the opinion you couldn't do it, that people were unchangeable in that way. But then I was thinking about what my next book project would be. And the opinion polls started coming back right before the Supreme Court ruled on same-sex marriage. And I saw that, you know, attitudes toward LGBT rights, LGBT people, and same-sex marriage in the United States, in just 12 years, they went from 70% opposed to 70% in favor. And I imagined getting in a time machine, like that these are millions of people in the United States that could get into a time machine and go back just 12 years. And if they, you know, if they met themselves 12 years ago, they would disagree. They would argue with themselves vehemently. And so the very notion of what's right and wrong and what's true and untrue had changed for so many people. It gave me this this feeling of hope and optimism that we change our minds all the time. It's just we don't really understand how it works. And it's very hard to look back at and know that you've changed your mind. It's very hard to notice how you've changed your mind. So
wait, can I jump in and ask you? I mean, I also find it heartening that people can change their minds, can move on issues. That means that conversation is worthwhile. And it's, but it also, I can imagine that some people might think, well, maybe that isn't so optimistic. Maybe that means we're fickle, or maybe it means, I don't know, that we don't know what we're talking about.
Well, that's true. I don't think we know what we're talking about. I don't think we have access to those places that either generate our opinions and beliefs or that change those opinions or beliefs. And you can, if you learn a lot about psychology or you become a therapist, you become an activist, you become better at understanding those things and operating in those worlds. But I think for most of us, that's not true. And that's why it was such a difficult investigation. And the reason we, you know, it's good that we don't change our minds on a dime. If we did that, we'd never be able to construct a model of reality that could withstand the onslaught of doubt and cognition that weathers us every time we have to absorb inputs from this chaotic and strange world. And we wouldn't be able to resist swindles and cons and mirages and things like that. So it's very nice that we don't change our minds immediately upon realizing that we might be wrong. But it's one of our greatest strengths that we do eventually come around most of the time.
So this started with the large scale sort of like transformation of this country on the issue of gay marriage. But what was your path as a journalist starting from there? I mean, where did you go? Who did you talk to?
Well, the very first people I wanted to talk to were a group of people called the Leadership Lab in Los Angeles. They had made some pretty big headlines across the country because they had developed a technique for changing people's attitudes on wedge issues in 20 minutes or less in a single conversation. And they had also gone through a lot of controversy because the first scientist to study them had committed this really bizarre fraud where they just copied and pasted data from another study into that study, and it negated the study. And it bothered me because it felt like the Leadership Lab had found something unique in the world of persuasion and that it was going to be thrown into the garbage because of this ancillary thing that happened with the researchers. So I went out there and traveled out to Los Angeles, and I've canvassed with them several times over the course of a year. And a new group of scientists studied them, and their research showed that what they were doing absolutely worked, and it was very unique. So that was my first play. That was the way I jumped into this.
Were they doing?
So they use a technique that they've developed. They're amazing. They're an amazing group of people. It's called deep canvassing, and they go door to door almost the way the way anyone would go door to door with a pamphlet and say, vote for my candidate. Except what they do is they go to the door and say, how do you feel about, gun control, same-sex marriage, trans gender bathroom rights, things like that. And if the person is opposed to those issues, they spend 20 minutes talking to them, and they eventually they have a pretty good success rate of moving them over. They conducted 12,000 conversations in the course of 8 years, and they recorded almost every single one of them. And everything that didn't work, they threw out, and everything that did work, they kept. So they did this iterative process that is basically impossible in a scientific setting, and they hit on something amazing. What they do is it's similar to a couple of things in psychology, like motivational interviewing, elaboration likelihood model. There's cognitive behavioral therapy. There's a lot of things that they sort of rediscovered on their own. But after they establish rapport and they tell you that they're not there to change your mind, they're just there to listen and ask questions. They ask you how you feel about the issue on a scale from 1 to 10. Most people, whatever they say is a guess because we don't really know how we feel about most things. We're just trying to make the person talking to us feel comfortable. And then they present them a message, usually on a video or an opposition ad, that they think will evoke their hidden prejudices. And usually a person has a very strong negative reaction to this video, and then they ask them what their opinion is now, and they will report that their attitude has changed. They're usually, if they said that they were a 5, they'll go down to a 4. If they said they were a 7, they'll go down to a 5. And then they ask, why did that happen? Why did your opinion change? And that's when the conversation actually begins, because the person goes from sort of autopilot to what they call active processing. And you feel cognitive dissonance in that moment. You're wondering to yourself, why did I change my mind? Why do I feel this way? Where does this come from? I don't want to be a bad person. I don't want to be prejudiced. And so as they describe it, they say it's like solving a mystery together. Instead of having an argument, two people work on this problem to try to figure out, where did this belief come from? And in the process of having a person go through their own life experiences, they usually find out that it's all received wisdom, that they saw something when they were a kid, or their parents told them something, or it comes from their culture. It comes from their group identity. And there's a good success rate there when a person finds out where their opinions came from and they realize that they did not sit down. Most of us believe that we, at some point, like Gandalf, went into a library and looked at all the paperwork and wrote down in our journal, this is how I feel about this. Like, it was a very conscious, contemplative decision. But when you realize that that's not how you came to your opinion, in a conversation like that, you have the opportunity to almost create your opinion for the very first time. And most people create an opinion that's far more progressive in a situation like that.
I'm curious, you've talked to people who have changed their minds too, right?
Yes, I spoke to former Westboro Baptist Church members, former 9/11 truthers, former cult members, people who have had drastic changes of heart.
Can you tell me one of those stories?
Yeah, I think all the cult stories are illuminating in that how rapidly someone can switch. But I think the most the story that taught me more about the human condition than any other was the story of Charlie Veach. He's a 9/11 truther. I visited him in Manchester, England. He was a rising star in the conspiracy community. He was becoming friends with Alex Jones. He was appearing on Alex Jones's programs. He was becoming friends with David Icke, who believes that, reptiles are controlling the planet, that a lot of our politicians are secret lizards. And he was a big time 9/11 conspiracy theorist. He believed that it was an inside job and it was a controlled explosion and all that kind of stuff. And he made lots and lots of videos, and he was becoming very famous in that community. So he, the BBC created a television program. I think there was only four or five shows, called the Conspiracy Road Trip, where they would take people who believed in a particular conspiracy and they'd have them meet experts and they'd see how they reacted. And in his episode, Charlie went with four other 9/11 truthers, and they traveled to New York City. They traveled to Ground Zero. They met widows and widowers. They met people at the Pentagon. They met officials. They met the people who designed the World Trade Center. They talked to demolitions experts. They really ran through everything you've ever wanted to do with someone who might believe something like that. They did that in person. And of all the people that went there, they actually felt even more strongly by the end of this that they were right all along, except Charlie, who completely changed his mind. He completely accepted the evidence, and he made a he made a YouTube video afterward and presented it to his giant audience and to all the truthers around the planet, and they ostracized him immediately. He was completely, his social support network was completely destroyed. It was eradicated. It got so bad for him that at some point they were able to mess around with his Facebook and find pictures of his family. And they photoshopped his niece and nephew's faces onto child pornography, and they sent that to his mother.
Oh my God.
They tried to destroy his life, and he lost his job. He lost his life, and he had to change his name. He basically has gone underground. He has a new life now, and he's doing okay now, but he had to escape from them because the internet allows for that kind of massive harassment.
I mean, so, I want to jump in because that is an extreme case, but this idea of there being social repercussions for changing your mind is not extreme.
No, and that's what I learned from this is that when I brought this to a scientist, Tom Stafford especially was very helpful in this. They told me that, you know, oftentimes research has shown that people will reveal that they have changed their mind in the face of evidence, but they can't admit it to themselves or others because they know that the repercussions are that they're going to lose their group identity. And as primates, that is one of our most basic fears. And it's important that we have that fear. You know, our relationships with others are incredibly important. And the idea for any primate that you might be ostracized and left alone to fend for yourself is just a super strong motivation. It's one of the strongest drives we have. And so why did Charlie change his mind then? Well, it was because, and I learned in interviewing him, and this wasn't in any of the literature that had been put out about him, right before he was asked to go on that road trip, he had spent about 2 years becoming, he'd also risen in popularity in another group of people. They call them truth Jews, and there's a lot of different words for them, but they're basically a sort of a neo-hippie or part of the UK, and they have festivals, and they're more about you know, peace, love, and understanding. And he had really become, and his partner, he met her in that organization. So he had a foot in two worlds, and he had a safety net. He had a social safety net. He had the freedom to accept the evidence. And since he could accept the evidence, he did.
Yeah.
And even though he lost one social group, he was able to fall into the other. And that's why he was able to see the truth of it.
In your podcast, you do an episode on the neuroscience of changing your mind. And the scientists you spoke with, Sarah Gimbel and Jonas Kaplan at USC, had gathered a group of test subjects who are very committed to political positions on the left side of the spectrum, and also to a handful of non-political assertions like that Thomas Edison had invented the light bulb. All of the people chosen for this study were like, yeah, I am 100% sure about that. So let's listen to what happened in their brains when scientists presented them with really compelling counterarguments.
So they come to the lab, we put them in the MRI machine, and while they're in there, we show them this statement that we already know that they believe in from their pretest. And following that, we show them five pieces of counter evidence for that statement.
Yeah, that's right. So they would see each statement, and then they would see five challenges or counter arguments against that statement.
So for the topic, Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, for instance, this is one that we saw a lot of change in people's belief, one of the most, actually. Some of the challenges included things like nearly 70 years before Edison, Humphrey Davy demonstrated an electric lamp to the Royal Society. Edison hired a young physicist named Francis Upton to help work on the light bulb. He had the breakthrough discovery that led to the light bulb development. Edison's patent for the electric light bulb was invalidated by the U.S. Patent Office, who found that it was based on work of another inventor.
And what kind of political counterarguments did you offer?
So for a political example, this is the statement was the laws regulating gun ownership in the United States should be made more restrictive. And the challenges were things like 98% of gun crimes are committed with stolen guns. People who possess guns illegally are unlikely to obey new laws regulating gun ownership. Every year, around 100,000 law-abiding gun owners defend themselves against violent crime, and more than 9 times out of 10 without firing a shot. People accidentally drown each other. More people accidentally drown each other each year than have been killed in gun-related accidents since 1980.
And then they'd see the original statement again, and we'd ask them after being challenged, now how strongly do you believe the statement on a scale from 1 to 7?
So what that does for us is we have a measure of how strongly they believed before they went into the scanner, which we know is either a 6 or a 7 because that was the criteria for it being included. And then we have their rating also in the scanner, and we can take those two numbers and by subtracting them, get a measure of their belief change on that topic related to the counter evidence that they just saw.
And we found, as expected, that people changed their minds more. They softened their beliefs more for the non-political statements compared to the political statements.
So this is from our guest David McRaney's podcast, You Are Not So Smart. And I want to just play a little more from that episode because what we hear next is really telling. Dave responds very honestly to this study showing that our brains respond to new information differently when it challenges not just random stuff we thought was true, but our belief systems. Here's David.
Now, I can immediately feel a difference in my thinking on related to these two topics, right? And so, like, and this is the great mystery of this. And I mean, I feel an unbidden, uncontrolled, and probably a lot of it non-conscious response to this new information. With Edison, I'm like, okay, I was wrong about that. Or just simply, I didn't know that. Interesting. Added to my list of things that I know. But with the gun stuff and, you know, whether either side that you're on, and I have spent a lot of my life in the Deep South. So I spent a lot of time around a lot of gun people. And I can play devil's advocate. And I can hear the argument already. But I can feel the quality of this information inside me being digested differently. And I'm assuming that that's what you found in the scanner as well. Is that true?
That is true. We found in the scanner that the more likely someone, or the more not likely, I should say, somebody was to change their minds, or the more stubborn they were about holding on to their beliefs, the more activity we saw in specifically two areas of the brain, one called the amygdala and one called the insular cortex.
The insular cortex receives all kinds of information from the body, and so it's really important for feeling things from your body. If you start to sense that your heart rate is changing or you're sweating a little bit. Your insular cortex is involved in gathering all that information and kind of presenting it to the brain. And we found that people who engage their insular cortex more, and also the amygdala, which is another structure that's important for emotion, the people that engage those structures more when being challenged were less likely to change their minds.
The amygdala, we know, tends to respond to threat. You know, if you were feeling somewhat threatened by this information, or even threat in the sense of trying to protect what you already think in the context of this new information, we do see more activity in those regions when somebody is less likely to change their mind.
And I think that's related to exactly that experience that you're describing.
The creepy thing about this is I don't feel like I have any control over this. Like, I feel like
absolutely
it's happening to me. You know, it's like a placebo type. I mean, like I have, I am at the whim of my meaty self, and I'm having to deal with what's happening to me instead of choosing what I'm going to think about this.
Absolutely. You know, it, from the brain perspective, we actually find the same thing, which is that the response in the brain that we see is very similar to what would happen if, say, you were walking through the forest and came across a bear.
Oh, okay.
You know, your brain would have this automatic fight or flight where your adrenaline goes up and, you know, you either run or you fight and your body prepares to protect itself. And in that case, it's in terms of your physical well-being and your physical body. But what we're seeing in the brain is the same kind of response. So interestingly, the brain is not differentiating between physical harm and needing to have this fight or flight and more quote unquote like emotional or mental harm of, you know, something that's attacking this other part of yourself that isn't physical. But in terms of the brain, for us, it seems like it's looking at it in the same way.
When we return, we will talk more about the neuroscience behind this at 816-235-2888 because we want to hear your stories too. If you have a story about changing your mind or someone else's, we want to hear it. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm talking with journalist David McRaney and neuroscientist Randy Nudo. He directs the Institute of Neurological Sciences at KU Med. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Pleasure to be here.
So talk to me about what you're hearing in this conversation.
Well, this is really a fascinating topic. We know that our brains were evolutionarily wired to allow us to make order out of seemingly chaos in the world. And our brains do this unconsciously. I remember camping out by a stream in the woods several years ago. And while the rushing stream does not have much information in it, it's just white noise. As I fell asleep, I started to dream about violins, and my brain instantly tried to make order out of it. And so when we get this bombardment of disinformation and contrasting information, this cognitive dissonance that David talked about takes hold. And our brains don't like that. We want to have order. So even in the face of information that seemingly is illogical and doesn't make sense, we hang on to those old ideas and they become very ingrained.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and we've got some input from listeners on Twitter and on via email. We have someone, a listener named Emily, telling us that she swore she'd never drive an SUV and that she is actually sending the tweet from her SUV, which she is not driving. She stopped. But what changed her mind was that her compact car got totaled in a hit and run, and she had a 16-week-old baby in the car. That brings up for me that when we think about the brain's ability to take in new information and change, I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, that the brain is more plastic. There's more plasticity in it right after you've had a child. Is that true?
Well, any kind of trauma can induce the state in the brain where it's receptive to change. Things like neurological injuries will instigate that process. Our brains are soft-wired. We used to think of about them as being completely hardwired by the time we're adults, and you can't teach an old dog new tricks. But in fact, we're soft-wired. We can change our brains, but it depends on the state, the neurotransmitter state of the brain. And so some of these fear-evoking stimuli that will change the way that we process that information. And not only how we remember the facts of the experience, but our ability to retrieve those facts later can sometimes be influenced by the state that we're in, our emotional state during that time of remembering. So even though we might be effective at teaching someone the new facts about a controversial topic, they may in fact not lay down those neural pathways to make some sense of permanence of that idea. And so when they try to retrieve it, they go back to the old information that's false.
Mm. Yeah, David, what can you tell us about this and just about what you've learned about the role of the brain in this whole process? We like to think it's like ideals and, you know, that it's not something hardwired in us to hold on to a belief.
Well, for me, you know, the way that everyone that I've spoken to individually who has changed their mind in a drastic way, their story sounds very similar to the way paradigm shifts take place in science. And there's a term that Julia Galef gave me a while back. She told me she's a head of an organization that helps organizations change their ways. She called it abeyance, and it's an old scientific term, and it just means when you have a model that works in science, you know, you have a model of gravity or you have a model of evolution, and it works. It seems to be solving the problems. Your experiments seem to match up with it well. If you have an anomaly that doesn't seem to match the model, they put it into what they call abeyance. And so In the book, I call, you know, each one of us has this bucket that we carry around with us. And then when we see an anomaly to a model that we have been using for a long time, we toss it in the bucket. We don't just throw the model away. There's a great experiment in the 1949 at Harvard where they had people look at playing cards on a screen. They would flash them with slides, and each subject just had to identify the card before they could move on. What they would do, though, is they would slip fake cards into the mix, and people did not notice. There would be black hearts, and there'd be red spades and things like that, and people would simply call them out as if they were normal cards. But the response time would get slower and slower each time they saw an anomaly, and they started to crank up the number of anomalies that were in the mix, and people started saying strange things. They would call cards grayish brown, blackish red. They call them purple. They knew something was off, but they couldn't put their finger on it. At some point, though, everyone was a little different. People would just have this massive existential freak out. They would they said things like, "I don't know if it's red or black. This doesn't even look like a card. This doesn't even look like a card anymore." One person actually said, "This is a direct quote." I don't even know what a spade looks like. My God. So they called this the shock of recognition. And really what they're describing is scientifically, this is what an epiphany is. An epiphany is not the moment you realize, it's not the moment you change your mind. It's to realize that you already have changed your mind. It's the moment that instead of trying to make anomalies match your expectations, it's when you start having your expectations match the anomalies. It's the moment that you give up an old model for a new one. And it's when you accept that's the moment you accept that you're wrong. And when you do that, you can actually see things for what they are. And everyone that I've spoken to, whether it was they left a cult or they left, they decided to drive an SUV, it was some moment in which the their bucket of anomalies overflowed. And they realize that the models they've been using to make sense of the world will no longer do.
You know, Randy, do you have an example of this that you can talk to us about?
Well, you know, I was just thinking of one of the topics that David sometimes talks about is our attitudes towards vaccines. It's a very interesting topic because we don't know. I think one of the problems is that this idea that we are tribal creatures really has a very strong effect, and that we will hold on to ideas even in the face of factual information in our individual selves because it doesn't fit the constructs for the tribe. And I think the vaccine controversy is part of this, and it's how you present that material. I was recently asked by, it turns out in Italy, they're undergoing a big change in the way they deliver healthcare and vaccines, and it's become mandatory for the first time for vaccines to be administered to children entering primary school. One of my cousins in Italy wrote to me and asked me about what I thought about the topic and could I shed some light on it. And I think this is very critical because when we have all this information from various sources, we as scientists, we can filter out some of that. We know we have a metric. We can talk about journals that articles are published in and where the institution where a professor might do his research. And so we have these very cut and dried metrics for what is how we value information. But for a subject like vaccines, how do we assign a value? So they came to me as someone who has experience in the medical field. And so I think that kind of information coming from me and in the field would have more of an impact than them reading the exact same material just at
in a
random.
Book or...
Exactly, mm-hmm. in a book.
Can I jump in there for a second?
Yeah.
So this is a huge part of... I think this is difficult for scientists and academics and journalists to grasp how weird we all are when it comes to trying to change people's minds. And this was a big problem for me. I'd say almost the entire first year of my working on this book, I didn't grasp this. And you can see this in some of the literature, too, where it's not grasped by current researchers and especially by the first researchers to look into persuasion. And I started asking a lot of scientists this and activists when this one question, which is when we say we're changing someone's mind or you want to change someone's mind or someone has changed their mind, what has changed? And that ends up being one of those bizarre questions where you're like, I don't think I've ever put my finger on that. And it's important with vaccines, especially, you know, in the backfire research, what I'm driving at is if you're trying to change someone's mind, you need to know what it is you're looking to change. Are you trying to change a misconception and therefore you're trying to change a belief, or you're trying to change an attitude? You're trying to change the emotional quality of how they feel toward an issue. In the backfire research, for a long time, there's been a lot of play among journalists to talk about how facts don't work on people, because look at if you tell people that if someone says, I don't plan to vaccinate my child because I believe vaccines cause autism, and then you show them all this information about how vaccines don't cause autism, that person then reports that their attitude has strengthened. And that's where the language starts getting mushy, because we're using belief and attitude interchangeably. The research shows very clearly that you can change a person's belief easily. You can get someone like that to see that vaccines don't cause autism, but it won't change their attitude. It won't change what you would call their core belief underneath.
You know, I want to jump in because there's also this issue of people of us living in an environment where people don't trust their sources of information fully. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of information coming at us all the time, people speaking very authoritatively all the time. And mm-hmm. I think that's maybe part of why just rattling off facts to someone doesn't necessarily do it. I mean, is that out of line, that theory?
No, I mean, well, they call it, you know, there's a term for it called the information deficit model. Is this idea that goes back to like the 19th century philosophers thought that public education would get rid of every superstition. Benjamin Franklin thought that public libraries would make the common person would be would immediately be as educated as everybody else, and the democracy would become super powerful because everybody would agree on the same things. Even like the cyberpunks in like the 1990s, they thought that the internet would finally make it so that all of us were on the same page and that no
it's
one
totally
would,
done that.
Yeah. Well, so each group never accounts for the fact that we choose what goes into our mind. Timothy Leary called it power to the pupil. And this information deficit model is completely wrong, because it's not that people lack the facts. You can't take the facts that persuaded you and expect them to persuade somebody else, because we're motivated by so many other things. Tribal stuff like we were just talking about, attitudes. There's so much more that goes into how we construct our models than just pure facts that we got off of Google or whatever.
I'm going to jump in and hear from a caller, William in Lathrop, Missouri. You can join the conversation also at 816-235-2888. We're hoping especially to hear stories about when you changed your mind. William, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yes, not concerning scientific or ideological change, but what is called in Buddhism impermanence of desire. And I would like to hear comments on that rather than someone being changed outside.
Well, what do you mean by impermanence of desire for people who aren't familiar with that concept?
Well, let's say you're dating someone, but you see someone else you want to date. There would be impermanence of desire. Impermanence of desire in all material goods, for example, cars, clothes, music, which was mentioned earlier, that sort of thing.
So like that we change what it is we're drawn to.
Our desires are whimsical to some extent.
You know, this idea of desire as related to this is kind of interesting, because when I was thinking about what it means to change your mind, you realize that sometimes there's a position you have that you change on. Sometimes there's an allegiance that changes or a loyalty that changes. Sometimes there's, like an attitude more than a position.
Mm-hmm.
Are these all the same?
I will defer to the scientist on this, but the tiny thing I will say is that in the end of history illusion experiment, one of the things they asked people to do was say, what was your favorite band? Who's your favorite band right now? And what would you be willing to pay to see them? What's the most you'd be willing to pay? And people would usually be like around $250 to see their very favorite band in concert. And then they ask, who was your favorite band 10 years ago? And how much would you be willing to pay? And most people wouldn't go much above $50. And so there's some impermanence of desire right there. As we grow and as we change, what we want and what we're willing to pay for, it changes with us. So that's very much something that's been locked down, quantified and locked down, but I'm interested to hear what the scientist has to say.
Well, this idea that stimuli can actually evoke feelings of desire is very powerful, and we know this very well from people that have various types of obsessions, for example, food obsessions, and just the sight of certain types of food in those individuals will trigger an area of the brain to become very active, and it becomes overpowering for that individual to control that behavior. And normal individuals don't have that kind of response to the same visual stimuli. So we're all very different. We're all on a wide spectrum of responses to these kinds of stimuli. But clearly, there are some overpowering drives that in some individuals that will cause them to seek out those new activities.
And is that hardwired, or does it change?
Well, that's controversial. There are some interventions with people that have, for example, eating disorders that will reduce the way that the brain perceives those visual stimuli. So it can be changed to some extent, but it's very very difficult.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we have just a little more time left when we come back for you to tell us a story about a time when you changed your mind on anything, big or small. What was the tipping point? At 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm talking with journalist David McRaney and neuroscientist Randy Nudo about changing your mind. And I want to get right to our callers. We have some people with stories to tell about when their minds were changed. We're going to start with Carter in Kansas City. Hi, Carter.
Hi.
Tell us your story.
Well, it's an interesting one, I guess. I grew up in a religious, fundamental evangelical cult here in Kansas City. It was actually a worldwide organization at one time. And so I was indoctrinated to live by their code, and that's how I lived my life.
Can you give an example of something that was part of this code that might tell us, like, the extent of what we're talking about?
Sure. So it was very fundamental in terms of, you know, a literal interpretation of the Bible and the New Testament primarily. For instance, we were not to be yoked with non-believers, and I'm using air quotes right now. so we couldn't date anyone outside of the church. They were very restrictive to my family. My grandmother lived in Des Moines, Iowa, and her health was ailing, and it was important for us to get up and visit her at any opportunity we had. And my parents were rebuked for going up during the weekend to see my grandmother because they missed church service.
Okay, I think we've got a sense of the scale of this. So yeah, what happened? Yeah.
So there was some upheaval in the administration and ministry of the church. A letter came out by a former member of the ministry talking about corruption, misuse of funds. We had a yearly, what we called special contribution, where we, in addition to our, you know, tithings, our 10% of our income, we would also have to come up with, you know, a ridiculous amount of money at some point in the year, usually in the spring. And so this letter basically outlined the misappropriation of funds, abuse of the funds in the ministry, and it caused a lot of unrest among the people in the cult. So there were a lot of people that left, basically an exodus at that time, and I was kind of caught up in the middle of it. I was 18 years old, 17 or 18, and you know, I just was kind of, the floor was kind of lifted or dropped from beneath me too. Sorry, I'm not using very good idioms right now. But, so yeah, I kind of had to struggle to find my own path. And, I was friends with, some people in high school. One of the things they didn't really like us to do was to be friends with people outside of the cult. We could be friendly, but not necessarily close. So our deepest, darkest secrets and you know, our deepest relationships were meant to be in the cult.
Having relationships outside of that kind of created an opening for you, especially at a time of like turmoil and chaos that forced people to ask themselves the question, where do I stand?
Yeah. And so this friend of mine, you know, at the time, you know, she was just kind of exploring and, you know, she was a young person like I was, and she identified as pagan. And so just listening to her story and listening to what she believed and just how remarkably different it was, you know, kind of helped bring me out of that. And I had some exploration after high school, in the summer between high school, and I went to Missouri State University after that, or SMS at the time. And then I started eventually getting into anthropology and studying human cultures.
This is such an interesting story. I hate to hurry you along, but do you mind if I just ask? It sounds like realizing how many different belief systems were out there was transformative for you.
Sure. It's not that I didn't know there weren't other belief systems, but just connecting with someone on a personal level that believed something entirely different from me and hearing their perspective was a definite, I would say, instigator or catalyst to help launch me into a new way of thinking and a new worldview or a model, if you will.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Carter. And now we're going to go to Kate in Overland Park. Hi, Kate.
Hi, good morning.
Can you share your story?
Yes, my dad was a wonderful, loving person. We were raised in a fairly liberal church environment, but when we were younger, we had some family friends whose daughter came out to us all as gay, and my dad just really had a hard time with it at first and thought, well, I don't understand why people choose to be gay, and that's just ridiculous. And over time, it was like watching him learn like a child would learn as he, you know, spent time with her and eventually her wife and, you know, realized that she wasn't making a choice to be who she was. And that personal relationship was really the important thing that made him change his mind, that he saw a person that he knew and related to and saw how she didn't make that choice, and that he changed his mind. He's since passed away, but he changed his mind and realized that, you know, he had a whole different viewpoint based on this personal relationship.
Yeah. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks.
David, are you hearing threads that connect to other stories you've heard?
Absolutely. This is a, you know, you do this, you talk to enough people and these things emerge. This is exactly what happens in every instance. And this is, goes back to that bucket of anomalies, that bucket of abeyance I was talking about earlier. This is even true with former Westboro members, as well, very much true with the woman I spoke to named Diane Binscoder, who left a cult. And I spoke with other people like that. They, you know, cults, they control the flow of information so that you become isolated. They make authority figures seem like divine authorities. There's all sorts of things they do. But in essence, the same thing is true across all of these situations. You are not exposed to variations of being a person, other ways of thinking and doing. And you don't get, you're, even with truthers and flat earthers on the internet, they feel as if they're in a group of people. But they're not really. They're not having that face-to-face interaction that allows us to get into arguments, to see other people's perspectives, to see where we may or may not be wrong, to fill up our bucket of abeyance, and so that the anomalies overflow to the point where you have to give up an old model for a new one.
I want to jump in and ask Randy Nudo, you know, we're hearing that the environment that we're in online might feel like we're having personal interactions, the same kind that you have with one individual face to face, but that there's something about that one person who you actually spend like physical time with that has a power that's kind of different. And I wonder if you can talk to us about that from a brain perspective. I've heard about something called mirror neurons, and I just wonder if that seeing another person's face is important to us.
Yeah, absolutely. There are these neurons that seem to respond when we observe other people's behaviors, and perhaps that hearing about their emotional thoughts and their experiences will validate our own feelings. And so I think that clearly could be a neurobiological trait that's mm-hmm. That's causing this.
We have a caller who I'm not going to have time to get to, but she's suggesting that it is pain that paves the way for change, which in a way I kind of hear in Carter's story, that this rift in his church left room for him to ask questions he hadn't asked before, to experiment with things he hadn't experimented with before. And I guess I think that she's talking about emotional pain. Does emotional pain, Randy, do something that opens doors for us in an unexpected way?
Well, clearly there are two motivators for events, our experiences to be laid down into memory. And one is pleasure and one is pain. And the neurotransmitters that are released in the brain that might have some impact on how well synapses form are certainly enhanced during those periods. So pain is a very powerful motivator in laying down new pathways in the brain.
David McRaney, before we go, I mean, just what are your big takeaways so far? Do you have a question that's just like still burning in your mind as you write your book on changing your mind?
I don't know about plenty of questions, but my biggest takeaway is we do not live in a post-truth society. We do not live in a post-fact society. Changing our minds is one of the greatest things that we do. It's how we have the world we're living in, and people are not unreachable, and it is worth your effort to work on this with people who believe differently than you, and it's worth your effort to see maybe how you're wrong. No, we're not a post-fact world, and that's just not how things work.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
David McRaney's podcast is You Are Not So Smart. And Randy Nudo with us from KU's Institute for Neurological Studies. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this show at kcur.org/centralstandard. And if you have a story about changing your mind that you still want to share, we are collecting them for future use. So you can get in touch with us by emailing centralstandard@kcur.org or on Twitter. We're @KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.